When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to. Lots to talk about the Wall Street Journal, the newspaper of the investor class, had an interesting story. They've come out and said, look, pay raises are finally outpacing inflation, first time in 2 years. Wages are going up. Inflation's going down. Things are getting better. Bidenomics, is it working? Let's see. No, I mean, this is one of these things where you go, you know, as we came out of the pandemic, things were going to be difficult to get started again. We're finally moving in a direction where, well, maybe through smart policy, through good investments, maybe things are going to be okay. Now, the Federal Reserve not thrilled, because if you remember, the Federal Reserve, they want to quash wage growth. There's a fear that that's going to cause more inflation and it's going to spiral out. Now, as I said from the beginning, a big driver of our inflation is greedflation. It's good old-fashioned American greed. Corporate America seeing an opportunity to line their pockets at the expense of their workers and their consumers and taking full advantage of it. Had to know it was going to happen. And I'm still waiting for the folks in the Senate or the House, either party, and this would be wildly popular, start going after some of these people who have been gouging us for the last couple of years. But according to the newspaper of the investor class, this marks the second straight month of seasonal adjusted gains. For workers, this is a good thing. Also, they're saying this could help skirt the recession that Republicans have been wishing and hoping and attempting to force upon us. Evidently, they surveyed a number of economists who have said, well, you know, it's a lower possibility of a recession in the next 12 months, which not news, not good news to the ears of our Republican friends who, you know, I think the only way they win in 2024 is if the economy tanks. And they're trying. God, they're trying. I did find it interesting that the newspaper of the investor class, they quoted a 60-year-old Brooklyn woman, and she said, you know, I don't see inflation right now as being the big problem it was months ago, and I really feel the ups and downs financially, it's sort of evens out. So things are getting better, even Amy says so. So this is a start. Now, can they screw it up? Most certainly. But the reality is according to the Department of Labor, restaurants and hotels and service economy jobs are roaring back. People are hiring. The quote was, at a brisk pace, because people have what? Yeah, disposable money. They got some disposable income. They got some coins in their pocket. And it's, as my grandmother always said, looking to burn a hole. So when people got money in their pocket, burns a hole, they got to spend it. And that's how our economy works. Not a bad thing. And understand, wages for manufacturing, wages for business services for workers also have outpaced inflation. You know, some of those jobs that Bidenomics is moving us towards. You know, manufacturing, construction, the kind of jobs that are going to pay a little bit higher, going to have some union rights, going to have a prevailing wage maybe attached to it that maybe is a little bit higher, a little bit more disposable, helps local communities. Yeah, that kind of thing. And as I said, look, you've got Jerome Powell, the Fed chair, you know, kind of, you know, we don't want, you know, we're okay with wage growth at the bottom, but, you know, we want that inflation target because that's their fetish of 2%. Now, President Biden came out today and said capitalism without competition isn't capitalism. I agree. He said it's exploitation. He says, I'm grateful for my competition council as we continue building on our momentum to reduce costs and deliver more results for the American people. And this is something that I've been wishing and hoping for a while. We start breaking up some of these big conglomerates, maybe use the Federal Trade Commission to start doing that. Maybe that's coming down the road. But we are starting to lay some groundwork to maybe begin to hold some folks accountable. Now, here's the thing. We're in a moment. This is a moment. This is like a crossroads moment. This is like being at a Y. It's like a Y intersection. Which way do we go? You know, the kids book. Oh, the places we'll go. Do I choose this way or that way? Do I choose the dark road or the lit road? 2024 is going to be one of those times. It's going to be about deciding which direction we go as a country. Do we follow the path that Biden has laid for us in Bidenomics? Leading us into, you know, reshoring manufacturing, investing in infrastructure, creating quality jobs here at home? Or do we return to the neoliberal supply side voodoo Reaganomics stuff? You know, more tax cuts for the very wealthy, handouts for corporate America. And look, you know, Biden's doing some hands out to corporate America too, but they're coming with strings. You got to create jobs here. And look, anyone who knows me knows I don't like giving corporate America anything. But the reality is we're in this moment, and Democrats had better figure this out. It's about what you're going to do to make lives better. And I think Biden is, you know, as I call him, Jelly Bucket Joe, is out there doing the job. But you got to sell that to the voters. Look what we've done. Look what we've accomplished. Look at the lives we've made better. And they've got to be doing more of that and running on that. And, you know, I came across an ad by a guy named Brandon Presley. Brandon Presley is running for governor in Mississippi, and this guy's got a chance to win as a Democrat in Mississippi. Yeah, in Mississippi. So I saw his campaign ad, and I'm going, you know, this is the way Democrats need to be coming at things. This is the way Democrats need to really be hammering on stuff. So I wanted to play his campaign ad, which I think is really, really good.
For years, my mama worked at this sewing factory. She grinded out each day with hands eaten up by arthritis. Those hands prayed for us nightly and loved us always. She was our rock and never let us feel as poor as we really were. I'm Brandon Preston. After college, I came home to run for mayor of this little town to help families like the one I grew up in. We balanced the budget and cut taxes for working people. Then, as public service commissioner, I stopped utility companies from jacking up rates on consumers and brought high-speed internet service to some of the most forgotten parts of our state. As governor, I'll axe the grocery tax and cut car tag fees in half to save you money. I'll expand Medicaid because getting sick shouldn't mean going broke. And let's put corrupt politicians right where they belong, in jail. I'm Brandon Presley, and if you make me your governor, I'll promise you this. I'll never forget who I am, where I came from, or who sent me.
I mean, you know, this is the thing. Start locking up those corrupt politicians. Take on a tax code that hurts working people. You know, this is the stuff. This is the stuff that Democrats had better run on. How to make lives better. How are you going to make working people's lives better? As opposed to the other side. And I saw a quote. Last week, you may remember Ron Johnson, the senator from Wisconsin, was you know, badgering a guest that we've had on this show a number of times, Amy Hanauer, and he went into this thing about Social Security and how it's unfair to the rich and how, you know, poor people get more out of it, and it's just this whole thing, And, you know, it's so unfair. It's unfair that we tax the rich. And you go, wait a second. I think we need to have an education moment around what Social Security really is. Social Security is an anti-poverty program. It is not a retirement plan. It was never meant to be your primary retirement. Sadly, as Republicans have broken unions and destroyed our ability to organize and to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, what's happened is defined benefit pensions are all gone. That retirement security that generations fought for, long gone. And then we were sold on a scheme. Hey, you know, you could get this wonderful, you know, 401k thing and you'll be a millionaire. And we know that, you know, I go back to what I said when an employer said that to me. I go, you know, the reality is they're not going to give a dump truck driver $1 million. And if they do, I'm going to need a wheelbarrow to buy a loaf of bread. Going to need a wheelbarrow full of cash because it ain't going to be worth much. And what has happened is we've seen a generation fleeced of retirement security. So everyone's looking at Social Security as that safety net. And you've got people like Ron Johnson and the Republicans who want to slash and burn this. And you look at the third way people, they're saying, no, we wouldn't, you know, we're not gonna go after granny now, and you know, we're not going to cut benefits now. But, you know, read the fine print. Down the line, we're gonna destroy this. And I look at what Ron Johnson said, you know, we shouldn't be taxing the rich to pay to shore up the program. He says if you're in a low income group, you're getting a lot more than you in return than you invested in. If you're in a high income group, you're not getting what you paid in. Yeah, that's what anti-poverty insurance is. We ensure that people at the bottom are going to not fall below the poverty line. And this is where Democrats have to come out and full-throatedly support these programs that make people's lives better. All working people. But sadly, you know, we're hung up on the outrage. We're hung up on the division. And it's infuriating. Because, again, Republicans have no plans. They have no idea on how to make working people's lives better. They only have stuff that's going to destroy and make things worse. Look at the policies. Again, I don't want to get into they're bad people. Some of them are. Their policies are horrible. Their policies have destroyed the working class of this country. And conservative Democrats have gone along with some of this in the name of bipartisanship. You know, people like Trader Joe Lieberman. You know, we could have had some form of Medicare for all for you know, a large number of people in this country. But thanks to Trader Joe, no. And this is where we as voters have got to get away from the outrage and start talking and start being outraged about the right things, I think. And that is, how do we support our families? How do we have retirement and health security? How do we have a better future? For me, that's the North Star. Want to hear your thoughts, though? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, perfect example of what I'm talking about, and the fact that Republicans don't have anything but outrage to sell. I look at the debacle today with Marjorie Taylor Greene. Marjorie, three names. She got attention. She got attention, and that's really all it's about. It's about her getting attention. And, you know, she took images of Hunter Biden in, well, let's say, less than flattering positions. Some would argue pornography. In fact, she argued it was pornography and showing pornographic pictures during a hearing. And again, it's for shock. It's to humiliate Hunter Biden. It's to do all of these things that you know, get her some attention. And my mind went, you know, where are the maniac moms for misery? Where are these moms for liberty groups? Where are the purity police? Where are the, you know, how dare you show that filth crowd? Oh, no, it was for them. Because this is the kind of outrage candy the base wants. They want this kind of stuff. It's what they need. It's what they get off on. And look, it has to get more outrageous every day. So this is a natural... this is a natural step in, you know, just destroying the institution of Congress, of destroying any decency and giving the people, their base, what they want, what they need, what they crave. Now, I find it interesting that Byron Donalds, congressman, tweeted out that Jimmy Raskin and Daniel Goldman said that the explicit images of Hunter Biden presented by MTG are too racy for the Oversight Committee and demand they go away. These are the same Democrats that want this material in our schools. Please spare me the outrage. And my first thought was, are there teachers anywhere in the U.S. showing little Hunter? I mean, are there any teachers who have been showing Hunter Biden pictures and exposing little Hunter? Anyone doing that? I don't think so. And this is the frame that the right keeps trying to scare people for. You know, they're showing pornography in kindergarten. No, they're not. And I know that these Moms for Liberty groups want us to believe that, but I've actually talked to some teachers who say these books aren't on those shelves. And the things that they do throw out aren't for kids. And here's the other part. And this is the part that's most important. If there is anything objectionable, there's a process already in place that's supposed to deal with that. What this is all about is, again, back to the outrage factory. Back to the, we got to be mad about something. We've got to be... because that's the only thing that gets people excited is when they're angry and we can slam our fist down and raise our voice and wag our finger. That really gets, especially on the right, where you cannot have a rational conversation. I don't want the kind of books in my kids' school that Maniac Moms for Misery claim are there. They're not. But this, again, goes much further than just this little bit. You know, I had someone the other day call and say, well, you want, you know, to kill a mockingbird on the... yeah, actually, there's some lessons in that. I read it, and I don't think I'm worse for it. Now, what's interesting, again, you know, this idea that the right has nothing to offer. Congressman Andy Biggs, Arizona. He was on Fox News with Maria Bartiromo. And Biggs, you know, comes out and says, the Biden people have $100 million flowing through their accounts. You know, it's not just 5 or 10. No, it's $100 million. And I guess, you know, that's the biggest number that his mind will come up with. And Bartiromo plays around, holy moly, I can't believe it. And he says, we got to get to the bottom of it. We're going to get slow walked ourselves from the administration and their partisans and their supporters. And Bartiromo goes, unbelievable. As much as $100 million taken by the Biden family? Is that what you just said? And you go, Do you have any proof? Well, no. No, but I believe. And I come back to, there's no bottom to this. There's no bottom to the lies and the fantasy. There isn't. It's now we're just throwing stuff out. Now, understand, they don't go in front of the person wearing a robe and put their hand on that book and swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help them, God. They don't do that yet. I'm expecting it. So as I've said, you know, I believe nothing that comes out of these people's mouths until they do that. Let's quick go to the phones. Got Alice on one. Alice, how are you?
Totally insane.
What's on your mind?
So what you're describing is called deviatizing someone. And many, many years ago when I was in college and was taking deviant behavior for sociology, that was how you cause a person or a group to become outcast, is you make all these outrageous statements about them and about their behavior. Of course, none of it has a basis in fact, but you keep repeating it over and over, and it spreads, and people repeat it, and the person becomes an outcast. And that's how the right operates, and that's what they did with Hillary Clinton for the most part. They totally deviantized her. And you can spot this with the right because they make all these outrageous statements and whatnot. And then when they're pressed for facts or to be shown proof, they quickly change the subject, or you get what about or what have you. But they're never able to produce anything.
Yeah, I know. I so-and-so told me so, and their brothers, uncles, cousins, nephews, you know, second removed brother-in-law's cousin, they told us, so it's got to be true.
Right, and that's exactly what it's called in sociology. That's how you go about, you know, causing a person to become an outcast.
Yeah.
And the other thing I wanted to say is, I just get so ticked off at the right wing and these stupid Moms for Liberty with their, you know what, if you don't want your kids to read whatever or whatnot, that's fine. But you have no right to tell me what I can allow my children to read. And I'm going to tell you what, I read everything. I learned to read before I started first grade. And my mother was a diehard Baptist, but for all of my mother being a diehard Baptist, my reading material was never censored. And I have absolutely no use for any group that, number one, tries to tell other people how to raise their kids, or number two, is so stupid that they can't even read some of these words. They don't understand the idea, so consequently, they lie and say, you know, it's a bad thing. But you have a good evening, Rick.
Thanks, Alice. Well, I got to tell you, you're the reason that they're going to ban the books. We don't want people thinking. We don't want them speaking out. And look, you know, this is, it's not new. None of this stuff is new. This has been tried and tested before. None of this is new. You know, the Moms for Misery group is just the next extension of the outrage that you saw from the Tea Party groups and all of the other AstroTurf groups. This is not new. This is paying one half of the working class to murder the other half. This is paying people to be outraged and organizing other people who want to be outraged. That's what this is about. And until the rest of us, you know, start waking up to the reality that we've got to put these people aside and vote. It's coming down. You've got to vote. This is what they understand. You know, look, there's never been the perfect savior candidate, in my view. But we're in a moment right now where democracy is under threat, where the world that I grew up in is under threat. My high school reading list, even though I didn't read all of them, I usually did the Cliff Notes. Because I was not a good student. You know, even that's under attack. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Right back.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, Florida. I can't say Florida anymore without laughing because it's just become so crazy. But evidently, and this is according to the Florida Phoenix, evidently the Board of Education in the state of Florida, they have decided that students at Florida's public schools, they're gonna now learn that black people actually benefited from slavery. That's right. They benefited from it. It was a good thing. It was kind of like a learning opportunity. Taught them some skills. Helped them, learn to pick, this, or helped them to clean houses, or just they learned skills and trades. How wonderful. How wonderful way to rewrite history and just take all the pain and misery and all that stuff away. Brilliant. But here to share some thoughts on just how crazy this is, I've asked my good friend Will Bunch to come share some thoughts. Will is a columnist. He is the columnist over at the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's also the author of After the Ivory Tower Falls, How College Broke the American Dream and Blew Up Our Politics, and How to Fix It. Will, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick. Thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
So blacks benefited. This was a good thing. Why should we be ashamed of slavery? It was a good thing. Learned some skills. Taught them some stuff for free.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say this, slavery was the original free trade school that we're always talking about. Turns out they had it prior to 1865 and we didn't even know about it. It's crazy. I mean, I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and I would hear stories about, if you go down south, you'll get a textbook and it'll tell you that, black people didn't have any problems with slavery, that they were, treated well by their owners and they were well fed and they, like you said, it gave them employment, so to speak, uncompensated employment. As time passed, thinking like, boy, that's amazing that happened in my lifetime. Thank God that era is over. And here we are in 2023 and this stuff is like a virus that keeps coming back. And it's almost worse this time. And, Rick, anytime there's a movement for racial progress in this country, whether it was the Civil War and ending slavery, or whether it was, Reconstruction, or whether it was the civil rights movement of the 1960s and what Martin Luther King accomplished, or in this day and age, the George Floyd protests, the Black Lives Matter movement. Anytime we see a push for racial progress in this country, this virus of misinformation and, this trope about slavery and slaves being treated well and learning skills, it just keeps coming back. I mean, it's so fundamental to the concept of white supremacy that so many people are aligning themselves with. It's really sad that it keeps coming back.
No, it's all about rewriting the history and not making us feel bad for the past. And this is where when we've done our civil rights tour and when we've done other things, I'm like, I didn't do it. We learn history so that we promise not to make those mistakes again. And doing this just to me seems like we're setting up the future for disaster.
Yeah, I mean, I know I'm going to butcher the George Orwell line, but that he who controls the past controls the present or the future, right? I'm going to get this right one of these days. But Orwell understood a basic fact of politics that one of the ways that we impose policies on people is by creating these myths and legends about the past that can be used to justify them. Or like you said, I think you nailed it pretty well just now when you said, making people feel good about themselves. This is the complaint we've heard again and again since 2020, that education about racism in our schools, real accurate education about racism makes white kids feel bad about themselves, and we can't have that. So it's getting more extreme by the day.
No, it's crazy where we are. And but, you know, again, it's this division where this should be something where we come together as a country and go, okay, look, our history is what it is. We solve these and we move forward. It just seems like there are those who want to keep picking at this as a way to keep us divided.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a political strategy. I mean, the Republicans have found, especially in the Donald Trump era, that this works as a strategy to, this is a way to them, they can build a coalition of, you know, 50% of the country, or probably more realistically, like 46% of the country, but enough to win in the Electoral College, you know, with this kind of philosophy. And winning elections allows them to do the things they really want to do, which is, you know, keep you know, stop unions. But, you know, those things like a higher minimum wage are popular.
Yeah.
But if they can, you know, if they can make the elections about how we feel about race and not making white people feel bad about themselves, they can win those elections and then use their political influence to get the things that are really important to their financial backers, you know, the business things, the economic things, the low taxes, the anti-union stuff. That's how it works.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I mean, I was telling you during the break, you know, that I'm actually writing a piece that's going to come out tomorrow about the growing number of people who are leaving Ron DeSantis's Florida precisely because of the politics. And I think the number one complaint, and like certainly the people, I mean, my column is focusing on a couple that moved from Satellite Beach, which is down on the Space Coast, and they moved to my area, Swarthmore, Pennsylvania, which is a college town just outside of Philadelphia. And the reason they moved is they don't want to raise their 2-year-old kid in this nonsense. You know, they don't want her going to schools. Their child is a person of color, and they don't feel it's a safe environment for their daughter to grow up. And so they pulled up stakes. I mean, they had no connection to Swarthmore, Pennsylvania. They'd never been there before April of this year when they looked at the house that they moved into. But they were looking for a welcoming, more progressive place to live in. And they knew that wasn't Florida under Ron DeSantis.
Yeah, no.
And the school stuff, I think, is the biggest part of this.
No, the school part is huge. I mean, at the end of the day, yeah. I'm looking at these maniac Moms for Misery, this Moms for Liberty group as just a way of destroying public education. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Will Bunch. He's a national columnist at the Philadelphia Inquirer, also the author of After the Ivory Tower Falls, How College Broke the American Dream and Blew Up Our Politics and How to Fix It. I want to go to the phones real quick. It's Steve from Chicago on line one. Steve, you got a question for Will?
Hello?
Yeah, you got a question for Will?
Yes. I'm wondering, how does one distinguish between things that, for instance, are being taught and advocated in halls of learning that are honestly debated within the scholarly community? I mean, the 1619 Project, for instance, has received a great deal of criticism from eminent names in the field, very progressive individuals, and who are tremendously respected. So is it fair to lump all of this together? I think critiques of the 1619 Project are legitimate. I come from a background of academia. I hold a doctorate in political science. I think that's legitimate, whereas some of this other stuff, you know, 90% of it is certainly something that we should be able to teach children. But we can't simply say, well, they're conservatives and everything they hate must therefore be fine. But there are legitimate critiques of some of this stuff.
That's an interesting question. Will, you got a response?
Yeah, no, I've got, and you know, I've followed the 1619 Project thing very closely, and actually listened to the entire audiobook of the bigger expanded version when it came out a year or two ago. And I think some of the I think on the whole, it's an excellent project. And yet I'm aware of the criticisms. I know that at least one or two changes have been made from the original in response to those criticisms. And that's the bigger picture here. You know, we want an academic climate, whether it's in our universities or whether it's in K-12 education. We want a climate of open debate. You know, we want a climate of somebody puts their hypothesis out there and we can talk about it. And you know, sometimes it can be criticized. Sometimes there's a mistake and it needs to be corrected. And I think what's so troubling about Florida is, you know, DeSantis and his crowd clearly don't want academic freedom.
It's more about indoctrination than it is education.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing. I think it's great to debate whether the 1619 project is accurate. The problem with DeSantis' Florida is you can't talk about the 1619 project at all. You know, that these laws have been put into place that, I mean, they do two things. One, you know, there's certainly specific language that, you know, prevents teachers from discussing certain subjects, you know, around things like race or other topics like LGBTQ rights, but things that are central to our history. The other thing is having these laws has a chilling effect on teachers. So they are terrified to discuss anything about race, even something that might actually be found legal under the law. They don't want to risk that chance of being accused, right? So it really harms education. It just makes for a tense atmosphere in the classroom, whether, you know, on whatever level of education it is, because you have this element of fear that's been introduced.
So last question I've got for you, last line of question, because I want to change topics real quick, because, you wrote this book that I think is fantastic, After the Ivory Tower Falls, How College Broke the American Dream and Blew Up Our Politics and How to Fix It. And I hope folks will take a look at that and help fix our politics. But I wanted to get your thoughts on the debt forgiveness. I'm not sure if we lost Will or not, but I wanted to get your thoughts on that. Yep, we lost Will. I was hoping to get some comment on the debt forgiveness bill. But you know, we'll get it next time. We'll get it next time when we talk to Will. Appreciate the time, Will. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1993. That was the day that President Bill Clinton announced his Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. He had campaigned for president, promising to allow all citizens to serve in the military, regardless of sexual orientation. Once he was elected, there was a great deal of opposition to his proposal. Military officials railed against the idea of lifting the ban on homosexuals in the military. Members of Congress and the public voiced opposition. President Clinton proposed a compromise he called Don't Ask, Don't Tell. This meant that military officials were not supposed to inquire about the sexual orientation of servicemen and women. Service members were not to be public about their sexual preference. This meant that if members of the LGBT community wanted to pursue a career in the military, they had to hide a significant part of who they were or risk losing their jobs. The policy stood in effect for nearly two decades. More than 12,000 officers lost their jobs because they refused to stay in the closet. It is also unknown how many more LGBT people decided not to apply for military service because of the discriminatory division. President Obama pledged to repeal the policy during his first election. It took 2 years after his election until Don't Ask, Don't Tell was finally ended by Congress. Some members of Congress issued dire warnings about repealing the discriminatory policy. But on the fifth anniversary of the repeal, President Obama issued this statement. Today, Americans can serve the country they love, no matter who they love. And openly gay, lesbian, and bisexual men and women in uniform make our military stronger and America safer.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So I wanted to get into a little bit with Will about the student debt forgiveness because, you know, look, I think at some point this is a policy that's going to help folks. The Supreme Court shot down the original plan. Congress is going to do very little, if anything, to help do anything on this front. So Biden has moved forward and done some. Now, is it enough? No, it's never going to be enough. But this is, again, another one of these moments where we've got a situation that needs to be dealt with. We've got a problem, Houston, that needs to be worked on. There needs to be a solution. Again, the halls of power, the wheels of government need to address something, and we can't. There is nothing. And the frustrating part in this is the fact that this isn't the only problem we have as a country. And to have the workings of our government completely upended and nothing possible to get through seems angering. I mean, look at the fact that, you know, the military used to be that thing that was nonpartisan. The military used to be something that Republicans were all in favor of supporting. And you've got the dumbest guy in the Senate, Tommy Tuberville, saying, no, we're not going to allow the promotions of military people to happen. And the Marine Corps doesn't have a commandant for the first time in a gazillion years because he's got he's got his panties in a wad. And you go, I get you're upset about something, but that's not where you take it out on. It sends weakness around the world at a time when the world is getting to be an even more dangerous place than it was yesterday. You've got this, and I'm frustrated with it. And as I think we all should be, I think we most certainly should be frustrated in this moment. So the more I look at this, the more I step back and go, you know, the idea being we got work to do. Now, this is one of those moments. This is one of those moments where I'm glad we've got a Joe Biden in the White House because the UAW president, Sean Fain, today met with the White House because, look, you know, they're negotiating a new contract for the big three automakers here in the country. And some of the concern is that the White House is going to play a part in it. And again, I'd prefer that it's in a positive direction. I would prefer that the administration, and as they have been doing, taking some of the power and the resource that they're putting into place and demanding that people have the ability to organize. I'm hoping that's part of it. We'll see. There's a lot of labor activity going on right now. You've got potential strikes at UPS. You've got potential strikes with Yellow Freight. You've got tons of opportunities. The UAW. So we're going to find out where this goes. Let's go to the phones. We've got Jay from Chicago. He goes by the disgruntled Democrat. It looks like he got a couple of questions. Jay, thanks for taking time for us. What's on your mind?
Hey, Rick. Chad. Chad from the Chicago area, and I think we got a bad connection. I'll try my best here. I just again, I'm getting tired of our party with the talking points, and you brought up something to the effect of the Republicans are killing the working man. Well, I'm a blue collar Democrat out of Chicago, and I'm getting in fights with my wife about what we're going to spend money on, gas or groceries. And, you know, I spoke with you before about it, but if you're going to throw that kind of stuff out there, you got to give some clear illustrations on how these Republicans are killing the working man. Because I, you know,
what policies,
again, I come from a Democrat background here.
I hear you, Chad. You know, what policies have the Republicans put forth, let's say in the last 10 years, that you think would help you and help your family? What is it that you think would help you?
Well, I can tell you what's easy and clear right now is 3-4 years ago, gas prices in some parts, especially around here in the Chicago area, were under $2. It was incredible. I thought we'd never see it. I refinanced my mortgage at under 3%. The Fed keeps raising rates. We want to sell. We're looking to get out of Chicago because we can't afford property taxes. And quite frankly, it kind of goes to the other topic of Florida. And your guest is saying that people are leaving Florida. They've got the best economy out of all 50 states right now,
with the highest inflation rate of any state in the country. Housing costs through the roof.
Call it what it is.
Insurance companies leaving.
You can call it what it is, but again, as being a disgruntled Democrat, I'd rather go move to a state that's got the best economy going for it right now. I'm trying to, my father-in-law is living off of a retirement in Chicago here, and he's struggling.
No, and look,
his
I understand.
Retirement was booming.
So let me ask you then, I've gone through this a couple of times with friends. I think what Biden is doing is moving us in the right direction. Inherited a mess.
Over $4. I don't mean to cut you off. I apologize. But I mean, that's simply a talking point.
Does
it's
he?
Not true.
Well, no, hold on.
And I'll call you out on it.
No, okay. Did we miraculously take over the oil companies? Did we socialize the oil companies? Did I miss that?
Well, we were a net exporter of oil. Well, at least during the last 3 years, were a net exporter of oil.
And Chad, companies are sitting on thousands
of leases.
Rick,
answer the question. Were we a net exporter of oil?
Those companies are Chad, those companies are sitting on thousands of leases that they've chosen not to drill. If you listen to their earnings calls, they are quite happy with where things are. Unless you're ready to go and start socializing the oil companies, what policy do you think we can impose on them? Look, I would love to go after the oil companies. I would love to go after the people who are gouging consumers and screwing over working people. I would love to. But I don't remember when we socialized the oil companies. I must have missed that.
And I hear what you're saying, but again, when you let the oil companies bail it out, that's when the prices are going to go down. I think shutting down that Keystone pipeline was probably a mistake by the administration.
So the Keystone pipeline, Chad, is working just fine. The Keystone pipeline is pumping millions of gallons of crude right through our country. It's working just fine. If we're talking about the Keystone XL pipeline, which is a different one that was never online, had nothing to do with the price of oil, would have never helped us at all because it's something we don't refine. We don't have the ability to refine it in this country because it is the dirtiest oil possible. It's the sludge that we would send overseas. It would just come right through the middle of our country and right through the largest water supply that we have. So I don't know how that was going to help us. Now, if I said this from the beginning, if you were going to take that stuff and refine it in Chicago, if we were going to put it in Chicago and refine it there and it was going to stay here, I'd get on board with it. But this was oil that was never going to come to this country. It was going to go into the international market. And I'm so tired of that XL pipeline talking point because it wouldn't have helped us, Chad, not a bit. It would have hurt us, if anything.
Well, what's going to help us, especially for the working class up here in the Chicago area that can't afford our taxes and gas? What's going to help us then? Give me some examples, and hopefully I could get in a debate with my Republican friends and kind of bring up some good points, because right now I got nothing. Like I said, when you're debating with your spouse over paying for gas and groceries right now, it's a tough call. So give me some of your tidbits of knowledge on what you think It's got to get done so we can get these gas prices under $2 again.
Well, I think
inflation is on the rise.
I got 30 seconds to answer your question.
Go for it.
I want Congress to go after these oil executives who have been gouging us blind. And we've got to interject competition into this. This is why I'm all in favor of moving to some renewable energies. You know, we're never going to get off of the dirty stuff. It's not going to happen. But we can start limiting some of it. And that's what corporate America knows. That's what the oil companies know. And they're quite happy with where the prices are. And until we take them on, until we expose that and force some competition in there, as you've said, it's not going to change. So I think that's a huge part of this. And until we start going looking for alternatives, yeah, I'm not sure where the prices are going to come down. I hate it as much as you do, but I appreciate the thoughts, Chad. Thank you so much. Look, it's a tough thing, and it's something that we've certainly got to deal with. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So again, you know, when you look at these gas prices, and look, they have been high. The reality is, you know, corporate America has been gouging our eyes out for so long that I think some of us have gotten used to it. But again, I want to see Congress do something on that front. But Jack from Wisconsin's got a couple of ideas. Before I go to our next guest, I want to get Jack in. Jack, what's on your mind? Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Well, first of all, answer, I think, to rising gas prices is to make a serious commitment to electrics and electric vehicles and renewable resources. And the question, of course, most people will ask is, how do we do it? It's going to cost trillions. Well, it's already cost trillions in the climate disaster problem. And we can pay for this. We have the money. If we stop giving away billions and billions to oil companies in this thing called the depletion allowance, it's been characterized as the biggest tax break in history, and it probably is. I own stock in one of those oil companies, inherited from my dad, and the quantity of profits these guys are making is absolutely outrageous. They don't need a tax break. We could use that money to establish a series of, for example, electric vehicle recharging stations in each of the gasoline stations that are now on the interstates and, yeah, and other highways.
No, you're absolutely right. And I appreciate the thoughts, Jack. Thanks so much. Look, the reality is, as Jack pointed out, profits through the roof. And until we go after the fact that they are gouging us, nothing's going to change. To me, I keep coming back to that. You listen to their earnings calls. They're telling us they're happy where the price is. They're happy gouging consumers because they know we got to pay it. This is where alternatives, this is where public transit, this is where all of the other stuff should be all forward. Now, the question is, you know, we want those EV charging stations. We want that infrastructure. We want those battery plants. We want that manufacturing back. But are we doing it the right way? Look, I hate giving corporate subsidies to anyone. I understand in order to bring that stuff back, to make it here, we're going to have to subsidize it. But here to share some thoughts on, are we doing it the right way? And maybe there's a better way. I've asked my good friend Greg LeRoy to come talk with us. Greg is the executive director of Good Jobs First. GoodJobsFirst.org is the website. They've got a new piece out called Power Outage Will Heavily Subsidized Battery Factories Generate Substandard Jobs? Question we haven't really talked about much. Greg, thanks for taking time for us.
Great to be with you, Rick.
So now looking at this, you know, look, I hate giving out these kind of subsidies and giving corporate America tax breaks as much as anybody. So are we giving too much? Are we sweetening it too much, or are we doing enough? What are your thoughts?
We think we've published two studies now looking at both EV battery factories just from the state and local subsidy level, and now the federal level provision of the Inflation Reduction Act called the 45X, the production tax credit code for manufacturing batteries. Here's the takeaway. We looked at five new battery plants that are about to come online, most of them joint ventures between the big three and Asian battery companies. And when you add up all the federal and state and local subsidies that we know of, and we can't find some of them, the total subsidies per job to these factories is between $2 and $7 million per job. And yet they want to pay below market wages, much less below union wages for these jobs. The value of the 45X credit is so big, it's going to give some factories more than $1 billion per year for years as the bill plays out, more than enough to build the darn factories and pay all the wage bills for those years. And yet and still they want to pay below market wages. That's just too much. And it's crazy that a plant that's already so massively subsidized by the feds is now also getting these massive, you know, billions in some cases, tax breaks from the states and local governments. There's got to be a rational ceasefire here and a way to make sure that we're not over-subsidizing something and not getting great jobs and permanent new manufacturing wealth for the nation out of this.
Yeah, I mean, what's frustrating to me is, you know, a lot of the jobs that left the country during the deindustrialization period, we paid the bill for them to leave, and now we're paying the bill for them to come back. Which, look, you know, we're in a screwed situation one way or the other. The only way to get the supply chain back, the critical things that we need for the country, is to invest in it. My problem is I don't know that we're going to get the kind of return that I would hope we would get. I don't know if there's language in it that some of this gets repaid. There's a lot to it, but I fear that as a country, we're kind of held hostage in this moment. What do you make of that argument that look, they're not coming back unless we fund this. This idea that corporate America is going to do what's in the best interest of the country is never going to happen. We've got to sweeten the pot. What's the argument there?
Well, look, the argument is 40 years old, right? 40 years ago, the U.S. House of Representatives passed so-called domestic content legislation saying that 75% of what you make in your auto fleet that you sell in the U.S. had to be made in America. The bill never got through the Senate. The Japanese automakers came in and built a bunch of early plants in union states in the north, you know, Illinois, Ohio, Michigan, places like that, Indiana, and deflected the attempt to enact domestic content legislation here. Now we're basically bribing companies to put in domestic content, both in the EVs, right? You don't get the full consumer credit unless the batteries are made here. And the same is going to happen now with the microchip subsidies under the Chips and Science Act, $39 billion for bricks and mortar subsidies for semiconductor factories. We didn't have an industrial policy for so long. We've had this vacuum, and suddenly the Biden administration is rushing in. And we wish there was more strings attached. We wish there was more restraint. We wish there was better targeting. It's about time. Desperately, we needed an industrial policy, because Germany's always had an industrial policy. Japan's always had an industrial policy. Lord knows China's got an industrial policy. We've had this wide open, you know, laissez-faire policy all these years, and it really hurt us.
Now, you know, as I've been saying, you know, I think Biden has done a good thing. I think they're moving us in the right direction by obviously having a manufacturing policy that we haven't had for a very long time, maybe moving a little away from neoliberalism and the free trade stuff. But, you know, the subsidy stuff, I've always been a little hesitant, being 100% behind. And I do want the administration to push for more strength. So how do we as consumers, how do we as voters, you know, how do we push for these things? Because look, I think the administration would listen. I think the administration might move on this. Any thoughts?
Look, we're also very generally supportive of the thrust of these bills, the intent of these bills, and the, you know, long overdue idea that we must have an industrial policy in the United States. Right on to all that. And the Biden administration is overcoming so much inertia and so much misguided history. It's bound to get some things not quite exactly right, but the big picture is great. So we think two things should be happening right now. To the extent states or cities are also subsidizing these battery plants and other things, they're also getting all the federal money. The states can still attach a lot of strings to the deals. They can still say market-based wages. They can help take wages out of competition, so it's easier for the UAW to organize. We want to do everything we can with public policy to lower employer resistance to organizing and make it easier for the UAW to reestablish greater density in the auto industry. Because in the long run, that's the real solution, right? And the other point is the chance for popular support for the union organizing. That needs to happen as well.
Yeah.
And the consumers using these things, right? When we make choices about which EVs to buy, we should be mindful of trying to buy those that are union built.
Well, I'm right there with you. But for me, it comes back down to more policy. You know, we've created this environment of low taxes for the very wealthy, low taxes for corporate America. Yep. I'm of the mindset we dig up Dwight David Eisenhower, the good socialist president from the 50s. We bring his tax code back and we start taxing these people at an incredibly high rate. And I think you will then see, you know, more investment domestically. I think you will then see higher wages and money being spent a lot differently by corporations other than just lining their pockets and buying back shares and moving overseas. I could be wrong, but that's where I would want to start.
No, there's a saying I like very much, which says prosperous places tax the rich. And it's objectively true. And certainly, you know, by all the serious, you know, Nobel winning, you know, economists and so on, we need to make our tax system more progressive. We need to tax the rich at higher rates. We need to, frankly, help reduce the deficit long term that way. But all the other things that we need to catch up on, you know, repeal the Trump tax cuts, repeal the Bush tax cuts, tax carried interest, you know, tax hedge fund managers, like real income, not capital gains. There's so many big whopping federal loopholes in the tax code that would make a huge difference overnight and would not hurt the economy.
Yeah, because here's the thing, Greg. I mean, you know, I get the yeah. I get people emailing and calling and saying, look, your gas prices are high, groceries are high, inflation's killing us. All of this yep. stuff is hurting working families. All of this yep. stuff, people are struggling. There's real pain, and I'm not dismissing that because, look, I'm one of those working people. I know what it's like to go to the grocery store and go, geez, that's more than it was a year ago or 2 years ago. But I'm looking at these corporate profits, man. I'm looking at these CEOs lying in their pockets, and I'm looking at this stuff going, this should be the target. Yeah, we're heaping all of this reward upon them because, hey, we need these factories, we need these jobs. But there's a part of me that goes, you know, it's time to start talking about big picture stuff. It's time to see the elephant, man.
I agree. And obviously we've got two pinch points coming up with the UAW, with the master agreement with the big three. Coming up at the end of September when it expires, and obviously the UPS contract with the Teamsters coming up at the expiring at the end of this month. Two big proving moments about whether unions can win better contracts and, you know, greater movement toward leveling the playing field and regaining density.
Now, I want to get your thoughts also, because like the CHIPS bill is subsidizing, you know, a massive amount of jobs, and you know, we are talking about, you know, bringing back manufacturing, which everyone agrees is a good thing. I think something we should have done years ago, should have never let manufacturing go. It was bad policy from the Reagan, the H.W. Bush, the Clinton years, the W. Bush years, and even Obama, all bad policy. And it's about time we're moving, and especially Trump, because Trump sold us on the idea he was going to bring it all back.
Right.
Didn't happen. So I give Biden credit where he deserves. But I'm like we've talked about, I'm still a little uncomfortable. So, you know, how do we create a movement of folks who are going to, because I think the administration's willing to listen. I think I said this before. How do we create a movement of pushing in a direction to say we demand better?
Yeah, I mean, certainly for our part here at Good Jobs First, we're trying to follow the money. And the money is very instructive because, you know, we haven't had industrial policy. We've had this kind of, you know, race to the bottom, war among the states, you know, second war among the states. That was a phrase coined many decades ago by Business Week, because we just have, you know, state versus state. We don't have any federal policy guiding our manufacturing future. So we need to follow the money and talk about how there's too much money being put in too few baskets, you know, too many eggs in too few baskets. Gold plating a small number of these massive battery or EV factories is not the safest way to spend the money. We need to spread the peanut butter more thinly and build more capacity, more skills base, more broad-based technology, more municipal broadband, all the things that make lots of things possible for lots of companies, and don't put us, you know, at the whim of, you know, General Motors and LG and Panasonic and Tesla.
No, it's an excellent point. Now, the president, you know, tweeted out today, capitalism without competition isn't capitalism. It's exploitation. And I got to tell you, he's not wrong.
I agree completely. Look, and we should also be supporting Lina Khan and her leadership at the Federal Trade Commission. She's under attack, obviously, now by the right-wing members of Congress. But, you know, fixing our antitrust policy, bringing our anti-monopoly laws into the 21st century to deal with digital technologies, we're way overdue. We're way behind the European Union. It's a matter of personal safety. It's a matter of saving democracy. It's a matter of saving entrepreneurship and small businesses. You know, it's SOS time on antitrust.
And restoring competition that the right used to tell us that they love so much. The website, goodjobsfirst.org. Greg LeRoy is the executive director there at Good Jobs First. Highly suggest checking out the work that they do. Greg, I appreciate the time. Great stuff. Look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Thanks, Rick.
Our good friend Greg LeRoy. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people of the talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, yeah, during the break, I'm thinking about, you know, the last couple of calls and, you know, again, the Hunger Games scenario that working people are always put into. You know, and I've got a lot of Trump supporter friends who go, you know, gas prices were lower, food prices, inflation was lower. You know, the Trump economy was great. And you go, it was not bad. And thank you, Obama, for building that so Trump could take advantage of it. And, oh, by the way, thank you, Republicans, for giving rich people a whole bunch of money to heat up an economy by going further into debt. All the things that we're told we're not supposed to do, they did. And, you know, more tax breaks and more handouts and, you know, all kinds of stuff. This is one of these moments where you, again, had a Democrat taking over an economy that was in shambles. Clinton, you know, took over a poor economy from H.W. Bush. What Obama got from Bush. I mean, really? Are we going to call that an economy? We're on the verge of massive depression. And then what Biden took over, really in the midst of a potential depression, a supply chain that's horribly broken, corporate America, it's all about them and the gouging. And nobody really, you know, I keep saying, where's this generation's Harry Truman? You know, when are we going to start holding, you know, hearings on gouging and what corporate America did to us during the pandemic and throughout these years? The Groundwork Collaborative has done an incredible job of listening to those earnings calls. And all of the oil companies, they were bragging by the fact that they are making record profits and not drilling. They're happy with the production level. They could ramp up production. We've got the capacity for it. They're just not going to. Now you throw in all of the other external problems that have popped up. You know, Russia deciding they want to take over Ukraine, and whatever your feelings on that is, we've got to support Ukraine, because you don't want Russia feeling that they can just, you know, steamroll over people. But that has caused a massive inflation in fuel costs. You know, I remember a time, and I guess it's just because I'm a little bit older, I remember a time where patriotism meant something. You know, I know corporate America loves waving the flag, but they don't do anything to help working people. And this is where I come back to. The answer to a lot of our problems, and nobody wants to hear this, because for a couple of generations now, we've been trained like Pavlovian dogs to anytime we hear tax increases, to lose our ever-loving flipping minds. And because, again, when we hear taxes, they're going to raise taxes on us, because that's what they've done. You know, they've said, we're going to give all these great tax breaks. And what happens? The working class takes it on the chin. The working class takes it on the chin all the time. And look, are the Democrats perfect? No, not by any stretch of the imagination. I would love to see much more progressive, much more liberal, much more working class centric Democrats. People like me, who know what it's like to struggle to make a house payment or put food on the table. People who have missed a meal or two. That's what I want in the halls of power. So for me, it comes back to the tax code. And when you talk about increasing taxes on people, you talk about who has the money. You know, Ron Johnson, the senator from Wisconsin, said, you know, they pay 30% of all the taxes. Yes, because they're hoarding all of the wealth. When you have, you know, three people who have more wealth than, you know, half the bottom half of the country, that's a problem in distribution. Jesse the Body Ventura, former governor of Minnesota, said it so perfectly. There should never be a billionaire. We should tax them out of existence. And I go back to that magical era of the 50s, where we had a top marginal tax rate of 92%. To where at the very top, that dollar over whatever the number was, I think back then it was $200,000, that dollar over $200,000 in 1953 money, which I think is about $1.6 million in today's dollars. But that dollar was taxed at 92%. And I've said before, I would love to have paid that tax rate because it meant I was making a huge amount of money. But as far as a society goes, you cannot have a handful of uber wealthy people making policy outside of this self-governance model that we have. You can't have massive corporations that decide that more for them and less for everybody else. You know, the reason the GM era worked so well is you had strong unions who demanded wage increases. You had high taxes, so the CEOs would never think of taking $20, $30, $50, $100 million. It would have never dawned on them. Because one, they'd have had to sit across from the union and justify it, because the unions would certainly want higher wages, which they should. But it was also, it was going to get taxed away from them. This is why I keep coming back to the single issue, if I could change any of it, would be a massive tax increase on the very wealthy. And like they had back during the Eisenhower years, 100 tax brackets, to where the more you earned, the higher you paid. That's the price of admission in this society. But again, we've been told as working people, no, we can't tax them. They're the job creators. We give them all this money because they know what to do with it. And they do. They know what to do with it. They make themselves wealthier. In this era of Reaganomics, have working people gotten that much better off? The answer is no. We're much more health insecure. We're much more retirement insecure. We're much worse off than we were 40 years ago as a working class. So for me, it comes back down to the policy and the people that we put in the power. Now, it's interesting. When AOC set a 40% rate on people making over $10 million a year, oh boy, the right lost their mind. I would be worse than that. Want to hear your thoughts, though? Email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Back after this.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
1-866-416-RICK. 1-866-416-7425. I'm going to take your calls the rest of the hour. I got an email from Jay. Jay says, we pay enough in taxes. I'm tired of you tax and spend liberals. Always wanting to spend my money. Socialism never works. Not talking about socialism. I'm talking about allocation of resources to best help a society move forward. I go back to, I wouldn't have called my grandparents socialists. I mean, they did fight fascism overseas, and they did come home and build the strongest, most prosperous working class in the history of civilization. And how did they do it? You know, this isn't difficult. You can look back to what happened. They came back to the shop floor. They fought for a share of the profit that their wealth created. And if you look at the graphs that are out there from the end of World War II to the middle 70s, productivity went up, wages kept pace. So the better trained work, the more productive, the meritocracy we're told is supposed to exist, the more people did, the more they got paid. As productivity increased through, you know, efficiencies, through technology, through whatever, workers benefited from that. They shared in it. Sometime around the middle 70s, productivity continued, you know, 45 degree angle, straight across, straight up. Wages deadlined. What happened? Well, an all-out assault on working class people, an assault on the social safety net, an assault on well, working families. That's what it was. Policies brought by conservative Democrats and conservative neoliberals. You call them what you want. The Reaganites, all of these pro-corporatists. Understand, the guy who wrote the Powell memo, Supreme Court Justice Lewis Powell, was a moderate Democrat. Wrote that you need to break up unions. Wrote that you need to take over media. Wrote that you need to take over education. You need to train people to believe in free enterprise. And they've done a masterful job, because I've had these conversations with hundreds of people. We're a capitalist system, and corporate America, they know best. And I get tagged with this tax and spend liberal, which you know, I fully accept. I am a tax and spend liberal. I want to tax the very wealthy, the people who have the money, and I'm going to spend it on the things that we need: infrastructure, healthcare, education, you know, you name it. The things that we, military, the things that we as a society need and demand. You got to pay for it. As opposed to my conservative friends who are like, no, we'll spend crazy amounts of money enriching the very wealthy, and of course doing some of the bare minimums that we have to, and we'll just slap the credit card on it. You go, but we're $32 trillion in debt. And yeah, you know how we got there? We got there because we kept telling the American people, though, that we could cut taxes on the people who have all the money and give them more and create a larger wealth class. And it was actually going to be good. It's going to be better. We were going to bring in more money. It was going to be fabulous. It was going to be utopia. It was going to be rivers of gold and honey, manna from heaven. And what do we end up with? Well, we end up with some $32 trillion in debt. Intergenerational debt brought on by making sure that corporate America and the very wealthy do, well, better. And this is where, you know, Jay, I'm tired of simplistic, that's socialist. Government investments, it's how the country ran in the 50s. Massive infrastructure bill. The Eisenhower years saw massive investment in infrastructure. Now, granted, we had to sell it as, you know, it's military. It's going to help us keep us safe. And maybe we can do that again. You know, housing, you know, our veterans, we got to keep our veterans, safe and well healed and all that, because we might need them again. Those children, maybe they shouldn't go to bed hungry, because we might need them to fight war. Maybe that's how we have to do it. Because understand, virtually every one of these programs is because of some kind of tie to the military. The first milk program, the first school milk program, was put into place because, well, kids coming out of school weren't strong enough to carry the weapons. They were malnourished. So as I look at where we're heading, we have the haves and the have-nots. I go back to John Edwards in 2004 talking about the two Americas. I talk to my friends with the Patriotic Millionaires. They say the same thing. It's their greatest fear. You don't get millionaires reaching into their pockets saying, we want to be taxed higher. We want all these investments. If there's not some bit of fear that heads will be on platters at some point. And this is the frustrating part of this. And look, I hate paying taxes as much as the next person. But it's the price of admission. And as I've always said, if you don't like paying taxes to our country, if you do not like paying taxes for the things that we as citizens want, need, and demand, you can leave and not benefit from the infrastructure, not benefit from the environment that we have. You can go. This is the part that drives me insane. Because with smart policy, we can go back to having that prosperous working class. The gas price thing always comes up. I'm paying out the nose for gas. And as I started the show off today, for the first time in 2 years, wages have outpaced inflation. If we had stronger unions, walk with me on this because this is important. If we had stronger unions, if we had 25, 30% union density like we had in the 70s and 80s, and wages had, kept up. I go back to my grandfather, 1975. He got 3 raises because the union contract said, hey, we're not going to allow our wages to get eroded by inflation. Had you had that, I don't know. Maybe the cost at the pump wouldn't hurt as much. But what we've had is no ability to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, no ability for our wages to keep up and our standard of living to not be eroded and destroyed. Maybe this is the way forward. Maybe the way forward. Want to hear your thoughts. Let's go to the phones. Got Lewis on line one in New Jersey. Lewis from New Jersey. Go ahead. What's on your mind?
Hey, how you doing, Rick?
Hit me.
Yeah, I'm calling because, one, I want to say I totally agree with everything that you're saying tonight. And secondly, I'm also very frustrated when I hear callers who claim to be Democrats just do what you're saying we should not do, right? Which is we should not give the opponent any opening to justify their harmful policies. The Democrats are doing something. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
When you ask the question about what has the GOP done, the gentleman couldn't answer it because they have done nothing for the last decade and more. And I just want to say something else, too, in regards to what you were just talking about. What people don't understand is, in a way, this country has practiced socialism. You can think of the New Deal as socialism light, but we can also think of the ways in which this government gives out handouts to industries. And the only thing they don't do is just take them over, but they let these industries go wild, and then we got to pay the price for it. And people need to understand what you're saying is what is going to get us out of this mess. Tax the rich. They have not paid their fair share. They need to. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
Strengthen the labor movement, because if you're not being able to meet your expenses, then that says, hey, what can we do as a working class to get more for what we're producing? You see? So I'm totally with you tonight, Rick. And that's all I wanted to say.
Appreciate it, Lewis. Appreciate the call. Good stuff. Thanks so much. No, I mean, and look, I'm not going to beat up on Chad over the comments, because, look, I understand people are frustrated. I understand people are angry. And what people keep hearing, what keeps, because the right wing echo chamber is so powerful, is it's all Biden's fault. It's Bidenflation. Biden did that. We got stickers all over the place. I understand. I understand the anger. I understand the frustration. I do. The problem is what they're feeding us is nothing but outrage. It's nothing but division. They don't have a policy. They don't have a way forward. There's nothing. All we get from the Marjorie train wrecks and the Gates and the gun fetish Barbies is more outrage-tainment. More gimmick, more circus. Where's the policy? And I've been asking this. I've been doing this show 18 years now. This is you know, been my activism, my passion. I've been doing this all these years, and I keep asking the same question. What is it Republicans have done solely that has helped the working class? What policy have they dreamt up? What policy have they brought forth, debated, passed, and gotten signed into law that helps working people? Certainly nothing on minimum wage. Certainly nothing on getting people the ability to make organizing easier. Certainly not a social safety net. They've tattered and destroyed that. What policies have they moved forward other than tax cuts that never seem to trickle down? And when we do get a tax cut in the working class, what ends up happening is they find another way to get it from us. I look at Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney was the governor of Massachusetts for a number of years, and Mitt Romney never raised taxes. He'll be the first one to tell you, I never raised taxes on working people. But he did feed the you-know-what out of everyone. In fact, 500 times during his tenure, during his 8 years, 500 times they raised fees. So that hunting license that you love so much, that kept going up. Your driver's license fee, that kept going up. Your car registration, that kept going up. Permits to cut your grass, that kept going up. Everything that you got from your government kept going up. And they do that because it's a double win. It's a double win. They don't have to raise taxes. They can bring in revenue. And it makes you really angry that you're getting nickeled and dimed and fleeced at every opportunity. Look, they know what they're doing. They want you to hate our government. And they're really successful at it. You know, government can't do anything, shouldn't do anything, should be small enough we can drag in the bathtub and drown it. And then they go about showing us how bad government can be run. And then they go, look, it doesn't work. And they've got a massive infrastructure that they've invested in over 40 years to tell you, see, it doesn't work. Told you it wasn't going to work. Didn't work. I look at where we are in this moment. And if the working class of this country could unite around the simple idea that we should be doing better, that our hours that we trade for dollars are worth more, that policy should help us. You know, I go back to my high school government teacher. Government decides who gets what. The reality is the wealthy have gotten everything that they want. Corporate America gets what they want. Why? They lobby heavily. They spend lots of money. The minimum wage in this country is still $7.25 an hour. What's it been, 13 years since it's last been raised? Totally eroded by inflation. And I know everyone goes, but Rick, you know, no one's paying that. Not yet. And if that's the case, if no one's paying it, raising the minimum wage should not be a problem. Should be a no-brainer. If everyone's paying $15 an hour, shouldn't that be where the no-brainer idea goes? Yeah, raise the $15 an hour. Everyone's paying it anyway. They won't do that. Never. Because again, they've told us repeatedly, and if you listen to what Republicans say, they're very honest. You got to give them credit. You just got to listen. You know, they don't believe there should be a minimum wage. If you're desperate enough and hungry enough to work for a buck an hour, 100 hours a week, no overtime, that's your right. It should be your freedom. It should be your liberty. This is why This is why they keep feeding us all this outrage. It's got to be what keeps you angry. Why aren't we angry that gas prices are higher and demanding? Now, we're going to drill. Okay, we're going to drill, baby, drill. Drill, baby, drill. Understand, the oil companies are sitting on thousands of leases. In fact, you know, like Biden, much to the chagrin of the environmentalist community, has opened up a portion of Alaska. There's going to be more drill, baby, drilling there. It's going to happen. And look, I'm an environmentalist. I'm telling you, we're not ever getting off of the dirty stuff. The renewables that are coming hopefully will bring down our dependence on the other stuff and make us less dependent and less, well, fleeceable, if you will. But I got questions and problems with the other side as well. Are we going to go on all EVs, and what's going to happen to the electric prices? You know what I would love to see? I'd love to see a policy that makes every home energy independent. Solar panels, geothermal, you name it. So that you plug in your car, you're off the grid, you're producing what you need. You know why that'll never happen? Because corporate America can't profit from it. But I don't hear anyone talking about those ideas. No, no. It's all about ensuring corporate profits, because we've been trained like that. Anything else, that would be socialism. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back to wrap things up. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Think Tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at therickSmithShow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1848. That was the day the Convention on Women's Rights began in Seneca Falls, New York. The organizers of this convention brought together some of the leading women's activists of the day, such as Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and Lucretia Mott. The meeting included numerous discussions on the role of women in society. Leaders presented a declaration of sentiments. It included a list of oppressions faced by women of the day. Several had to do with work and economic issues. For example, it noted that men monopolized nearly all the profitable employments, while women could earn only a scanty remuneration. It also declared, "He closes against her all the avenues of wealth and distinction, which he considers most honorable to himself. As a teacher of theology, medicine, or law, she is not known." Despite these limitations, many women, poor women in particular, were forced by economic necessity to work. By 1840, 8,000 women and girls as young as 13 worked in the New England textile mills. Women almost always earned far less than men. Female textile mill workers in Massachusetts had formed the first union of working women in the United States, the Lowell Female Labor Reform Association. Of course, the Seneca Falls Women's Rights Convention provoked scorn and outrage from many, especially men. A local newspaper wrote, "This bolt is the most shocking and unnatural incident ever recorded in the history of humanity. If our ladies will insist on voting and legislating, where, gentlemen, will be our dinners and our elbows? Where are domestic firesides and the holes in our stockings?" Even today, women still earn less than men. For every dollar men earn, women only earn 78 cents.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Website, therickSmithShow.com. I want to go through a couple of things that I think the Biden administration doing well. It's things that don't get any attention whatsoever, but it's our tax dollars at work. It's what's helping working people. And again, this is the stuff that it doesn't make the news. It's not sexy. It's not, you know, something that people run campaigns on. But the reality is OSHA has reissued some record-keeping rules to ensure that, you know, workers that are seriously injured, you know, maybe we start, you know, we start looking into. If you remember during the Obama years, they had issued an improvement to the record-keeping rule requiring large establishments to send OSHA information about every serious worker injury. Trump did away with all that. Now, when they say, you know, these are places of 100 or more employees, that's coming back because we should have the kind of data to make sure that workplaces are safer. Also, MSHA, the Mine Safety and Health Administration, has also proposed a standard to protect miners from deadly silica dust. You may remember during the Trump years, one of the first executive orders that Trump railed out was, you know, deregulating, you know, some of that dust stuff, the silica, the barium, this, you know, some of that stuff that, yeah, you know, a little won't hurt you. This is coming back. And I think that's a good thing. There is also a proposal to act on protecting workers from heat and smoke. You know, over the last couple of weeks here where I live, Canada's killing us. The air quality, not great. The heat in places like Texas, not good and going to get worse. We need to get ahead of policy to protect working people on the job. Now, understand, you know, as a union guy, this is stuff that you will sit down and you will negotiate over. And we're seeing this in the UPS contract. The fact that they don't have air conditioning in the truck, one of the things that they fought for and have tentatively won, that's a big deal. The fact that they're talking about temperature and ensuring that, you know, their members, those Teamster members, don't die on the job or pass out, kind of an important thing. Maybe having a law, also not a bad idea. This is one of those things where I've not talked about on the show often, but I've always wondered about. Evidently, OSHA is also looking at somehow to protect women who are real estate agents. I mean, you stop and you think about it. These women go into these houses with who knows who, alone most of the time, and vulnerable. They're saying, look, you know, the fact that these are independent contractors means they don't have protection under, you know, what is it, Title VII or OSHA. There's something has to be done. This is a start to move in a good direction. At least that's my thought. Also, OSHA has announced a program to protect warehouse workers. There are some, 2 million people who work in warehouses now. And, you know, you look at Amazon and the fact that they're at the top of all of the negatives for injury rates and you know, ergonomic stuff. There should be some laws in place to protect people. Now, again, this is where me as a union guy have always said in the past, this is why we have unions. Wages, hours, conditions. Sadly, we're in a moment where 6.6% of the private sector workforce is unionized, and our laws are so badly broken that it's really hard for people to organize, especially when you're looking at, you know, these big behemoths like Amazon. You know, Staten Island, the Amazon facility there, when was that election? 2 years ago now? Longer? I don't even remember how long ago it was. They still don't have a contract because, well, our laws are that badly broken. Whereas, you know, in any functional system, those folks would have a contract. They would have the ability to negotiate over the conditions of that warehouse and make things better. They don't now. So this is why they're saying that OSHA should do something. They've launched a national emphasis program, and it's going to look at warehouse workers and figure out how to, well, make lives better. And for me, this is what government is supposed to do. Look, this is why I'm a fan of President Biden. I think they're putting people into places that are going to help working people. I go back to the Trump years, and you know, and I've just read through some things that they're making better. During the Trump years, I was probably sitting here telling you all of the things that they're deregulating and making worse. So for me, we're in a moment where it's not that difficult to decide which side you're on. And I know, you know, things, it's a struggle for a lot of folks. I get it. But this is why we make work pay. This is why we fight for a better future. And I look at the party who's trying to do that, and it ain't my Republican friends. Wish they were, but they're not. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. Wherever you find your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.